I cannot convey the sense of abominable desolation that hung over the world. The red eastern sky, the northward blackness, the salt dead sea, the stony beach crawling with these foul, slow-stirring monsters, the uniform, poisonous-looking green of the lichenous plants, the thin air that hurt one's lungs, all contributed to an appalling effect. I moved on, stopping ever and again, in great strides of 1,000 years or more, drawn on by the mystery of the earth's fate, watching with a strange fascination the sun grow larger and duller in the westward sky, and the life of the old earth ebb away. At last, more than 30 million years hence, I stopped once more. For the crawling multitude of crabs had disappeared, and the red beach, save for its livid green liverworts and lichens, seemed lifeless. And now it was flecked with white. A bitter cold assailed me. Rare white flakes came eddying down. There were fringes of ice along the sea margin, with drifting masses further out, but the main expanse of that salt ocean, all bloody under the eternal sunset, was still unfrozen. I looked about me to see if any traces of animal life remained, but I saw nothing moving, in earth or sky or sea. The green slime on the rocks alone testified that life was not extinct. On a shallow sandbank, which had appeared in the sea, I fancied I saw some black object flopping about. But it became motionless as I looked at it, and I judged that my eye had been deceived. A horror came on me. The cold that smote to my marrow and the pain I felt in breathing overcame me. I shivered, and a deadly nausea seized me. Then, like a red-hot bow in the sky, appeared the edge of the sun. I got off the machine to recover myself. I felt giddy and incapable of facing the return journey. As I stood sick and confused, I saw again the moving thing upon the shoal. There was no mistake now that it was a moving thing, against the red water of the sea. It was a round thing, and tentacles trailed down from it. It seemed black against the weltering blood-red water, and it was hopping fitfully about. Then I felt I was fainting, but a terrible dread of lying helpless in that remote and awful twilight sustained me while I clambered upon the saddle. So I came back. For a long time I must have been insensible upon the machine. The blinking successions of the days and nights was resumed. The sun got golden again, the sky blue. I breathed with greater freedom. The hands spun backward upon the dials. At last I saw again the dim shadows of houses, the evidences of decadent humanity. These too changed and passed, and others came. Presently I slackened speed. Then the old walls of the laboratory came round me. I slowed the mechanism down, then stopped, and saw about me again the old familiar laboratory, my tools, my appliances, just as I had left them. I got off the thing very shakily. Presently I got up and came through the passage here, limping. I heard your voices and the clatter of plates. You know the rest. I washed and dined, and now I am telling you the story. I know, he said after a pause, that all this will be absolutely incredible to you, but to me the one incredible thing is that I am here tonight in this old familiar room, looking into your friendly faces, and telling you these strange adventures. He looked at the medical man. No, I cannot expect you to believe it. Take it as a lie or a prophecy. Say I dreamed it in the workshop. And taking it as a story, what do you think of it? There was a momentary stillness. Then chairs began to creak and shoes to scrape upon the carpet. I looked round at his audience. The medical man seemed absorbed in the contemplation of our host. The editor was looking hard at the end of his cigar, the sixth. The journalist fumbled for his watch. The others were motionless. The editor stood up with a sigh. "What a pity it is you're not a writer of stories," he said, putting his hand on the time traveler's shoulder. "You don't believe it?" "Well, I thought not. To tell you the truth, I hardly believe it myself. And yet..." His eye fell with a mute inquiry upon the withered white flowers upon the little table. Then he turned over the hand holding his pipe, and I saw he was looking at some half-healed scars on his knuckles. The medical man rose, came to the lamp, and examined the flowers. "The gynaecium's odd," he said. The psychologist leaned forward to see, holding out his hands for a specimen. "I'm hanged if it isn't 1:45," said the journalist. "How shall we get home?" "Plenty of cabs at the station," said the psychologist. "It's a curious thing," said the medical man, "but I certainly don't know the natural order of these flowers. Where did you really get them?" The time traveler put his hand to his head. He spoke like one who was trying to keep hold of an idea that eluded him. "They were put into my pocket by Weena, when I traveled into time. I shared a cab with the editor. He thought the tale a gaudy lie. For my own part, I was unable to come to a conclusion. The story was so fantastic and incredible, the telling so credible and sober. I lay awake most of the night thinking about it. I determined to go next day and see the time traveler again. I was told he was in the laboratory, and, being on easy terms in the house, I went up to him. The laboratory, however, was empty. I stared for a minute at the time machine, and put out my hand and touched the lever. At that, the squat, substantial-looking mass swayed like a bough shaken by the wind. I came back through the corridor. The time traveler met me in the smoking room. He was coming from the house. He had a small camera under one arm and a knapsack under the other. He laughed when he saw me and gave me an elbow to shake. "I am frightfully busy," said he, "with that thing in there." "But is it not some hoax?" I said. "Do you really travel through time?" "Really and truly, I do." And he looked frankly into my eyes. He hesitated. His eye wandered about the room. "I only want half an hour," he said. "There's some magazines here. If you'll stop to lunch, I'll prove this time traveling up to the hilt, specimens and all, if you'll forgive my leaving you now." I consented, hardly comprehending then the full import of his words, and he nodded and went down the corridor. I heard the door of the laboratory slam, seated myself in a chair, and took up a daily paper. What was he going to do before lunchtime? Then suddenly I was reminded that I had promised to meet Richardson, the publisher, at 2. I looked at my watch and saw that I could barely save that engagement. I got up and went down the passage to tell the time traveler. As I took hold of the handle of the door, I heard an exclamation, oddly truncated at the end, and a click and a thud. A gust of air whirled around me as I opened the door, and from within came the sound of broken glass falling on the floor. The time traveler was not there. I seemed to see a ghostly, indistinct figure sitting in a whirling mass of black and brass for a moment, but this phantasm vanished as I rubbed my eyes. The time machine had gone. Save for the subsiding stir of dust, the further end of the laboratory was empty. A pane of the skylight had apparently just been blown in. I felt an unreasonable amazement. I understood. At the risk of disappointing Richardson, I stayed on waiting for the time traveler, waiting for the second, perhaps still stranger story, and the specimens and photographs he would bring with him. But I am beginning now to fear that I must wait a lifetime. The time traveler vanished 3 years ago, and as everybody knows now, he has never returned. One cannot choose but wonder, will he ever return? It may be that he swept back into the past and fell among the blood-drinking hairy savages of the age of unpolished stone, into the abysses of the Cretaceous Sea, or among the grotesque saurians, the huge reptilian brutes of the Jurassic times. He may even now, if I may use the phrase, be wandering on some plesiosaurus-haunted oolitic coral reef, or beside the lonely saline lakes of the Triassic age. Or did he go forward? Into one of the nearer ages, in which men are still men, but with the riddles of our own time answered and its wearisome problem solved, into the manhood of the race, for I, for my own part, cannot think that these latter days of weak experiment, fragmentary theory, and mutual discord are indeed man's culminating time. I say, for my own part. He, I know, for the question had been discussed among us long before the time machine was made, thought but cheerlessly of the advancement of mankind, and saw in the growing pile of civilization only a foolish heaping that must inevitably fall back upon and destroy its makers in the end. If that is so, it remains for us to live as though it were not so. But to me the future is still black and blank, is a vast ignorance lit at a few casual places by the memory of his story. And I have by me, for my comfort, 2 strange white flowers, shriveled now, and brown and flat and brittle, to witness that even when mind and strength had gone, gratitude and a mutual tenderness still lived on in the heart of man.